Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And well, this is quite an important episode. And I've probably mentioned this embarrassingly so, trying not to embarrass the guest. But when I set this podcast up, I had a bucket list of two people to get on. And one of which I'm thrilled to say is today's guest. And that person is Maxine Peake. And it was just an absolute joy. I've been a huge fan of Maxine's work for as long as she's been, you know, in the public eye. And it was just a real privilege to sit down with someone who, aside from everything, was super fun. We had such a laugh as well. And we talk about some great records and we talk about clubbing and all the usual stuff we do on this podcast. And you're in for a real treat. And I kind of try and keep a lid on the fandom on this one. But it's a lovely chat and I can't wait for you to hear it. So I'll get the quick bits out of the way, the big thank you. So thank you to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to 76 for producing this. And if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, when you finish listening to this one, go and have a look in the archives, because there's over 150 episodes with loads of your favourite actors, musicians, producers, DJs, comedians. Go and have a rummage around and see if there's something that you want to listen to. But yeah, this gives me a lot of happiness to say this. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Maxine Peake. Listen up. I've only got another new sponsor. Egg Fried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this. They have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Egg Fried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Keep me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we're recording. Sitting opposite me today in Salford via Zoom, Maxine Peake, hello.
Hello, Stu. How are you?
I'm good. I didn't think this was going to happen. I think you turned up and I could see you, but I couldn't hear you. And you used a stroke of genius. You went right old school, wrote it down on a bit of paper and held it up in front of the camera. I'm super excited about this today. And I'm going to get the cringy bit out of the way quickly, Max, if that's all right. When I set this podcast up 3 years ago, I had two guests that were on my list of people that I wanted to speak to. One was you and one was Johnny Marr. So,
get away. Thanks,
Dave. So I'm really, really excited to chat to you today. I just want to ask, before we sort of get into the songs and stuff, how have you found lockdown as as a human being and as a creative?
Hard like everybody else, but then not it's not been unbearable. And I think because as an actor and as a lot of self-employed and people in the creative industries, you do expect to have a type amount of time out to work. But I think it's the uncertainty that's been quite anxiety inducing. You go, well, when can we start again? And then just feeling for friends and colleagues and just hearing about people in the business, that you go, will they be able to ride this out? I'm in a very privileged position where financially I'm, touch wood, depending on how long it goes on, you think I can ride this out. But I think, we will lose a lot of people who will go, well, I can't stay within this business anymore. And especially it's the real creatives. I know people are doing a lot to save buildings, which of course is needed, but it's the people that make the building.
Yeah.
And I think, to me, that's paramount, is, supporting the actual physical creators, in their sort of future.
Because there was two venues in Manchester, wasn't there? Like music venues that looked like they were about to close. And thankfully, someone stepped in and kind of, I don't know if they bought them out or what they done, but they saved two really key live venues, didn't they?
Yeah, well, Gorilla, which I love Gorilla. It's a fantastic space. I've seen some fantastic acts there. And yeah, there was talk of that. I don't quite know what's happened to it. But, we've got the theatre, the Royal Exchange. I mean, that's still, I don't quite know. But, it's difficult. There's going to be a lot of people who will probably have to be made redundant. And I know they're fighting tooth and nail, the theatre, to keep everybody employed. But it's, when can it open again and how can it open? And then how does the theatre will move forward.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, I run a live venue down here, and I mean, we're speaking on a day, I think, this is a few days before, I believe, theatres are allowed to reopen.
Yeah.
But I think that's all well and good saying that, but if the restrictions are in place that are going to put so much financial strain on, people to put these kind of events on, it's going to be tough. If you can only sell a third of the tickets and yet your production costs are still the same, it's going to be an ongoing struggle, I think.
Well, I think so, and I think obviously productions will be smaller, there'll be probably lots of one person shows or two people, and then you start to think out of that. I mean, obviously I'm quite selfishly thinking about my the industry I'm in, but you think about television and film, and you think, well, that will have a knock-on effect because there'll be a lot more people vying for those jobs, and probably people with a bit of a profile be going for jobs that maybe they wouldn't, ever, not sliding down the ladder. It's a very unfair business, and we all know in anything profile and all that makes a big difference.
But compromising where they want to go.
Yeah, and you sort of think, so that'll have a knock-on effect that people, you just feel that then there'll be people pushed off the bottom of the...
Yeah.
Not the bottom, but...
I know what you're saying, totally.
It's sort of... You see it before lockdown that people were getting, you think, oh, interesting, they're doing that. Or people would say, God, I normally should just get off of these parts. Now I have to go and audition all those parts and now go on to somebody who's got a name and blah, blah, blah. So you do really, you worry that it's, and it's always hits the people who don't, who are the, it always hits the most vulnerable the hardest, doesn't
always.
It? The people, it's, the way it goes, and that's what's devastating.
Well, fingers crossed, it seems that there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
I've been a bit
but it's been lovely chatting to you anyway.
there's always hope, and the exciting thing, the landscape's changed. And speaking to a lot of young creatives are coming through, and I think it is about creating your own work. It's about, maybe it's for different venues, and maybe it will make you, hopefully, the arts in some ways more accessible, because people have to be really inventive about where they put things on.
Definitely.
I mean, but again, it's about feeding yourself, isn't it? And being able to pay your rent and whatever, And I can have a very idealistic view about it, but, hopefully, at that same time, people will be able to make a living from it as well.
I totally agree. And I think that it will. And it has already in lots of ways, created a kind of that that kind of punk DIY ethic of like, yeah. you know, working with your resources. And if they're limited, then it's like, right, let's see what we can do with those resources. So, yeah.
And you always get some brilliant, you know, that's when it gets exciting. And that's when the work's really edgy and exciting and current. You know, it's not just, will this make lots of money? And that's the essence of art, isn't it, really?
Completely. Completely. You know, so. Well, let's talk about some great art. And track one, Max, I'm going to ask you the song that you think's got the greatest ever intro.
Oh, is it? It's The Four Horsemen, Aphrodite's Child.
Okay.
Yeah, I love this. Somebody introduced me to this album probably about 10 years ago, and I thought it was a bit of a, you know, prog rock aficionado, but sort of. And who would have known that, you know, Demis Roussos.
Oh, I knew they were Greek. I did not know. Is that fronted by Demis Roussos?
It's Demis Roussos. It's Demis Roussos and Vangelis.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah. Before he was, you know, housewife's favourite in his, you know, crooning in his kaftan, he was into real experimental rock. So
I hope he's got an album called Crooning in My Kaftan. That would be brilliant.
But I just think, you know, if I always think about Abigail's Party, and I always think if she'd have been into earlier Demis Roussos, it might have had might have been a different play film altogether. But I just love this album. But this, to me, the intro to this and this track, it's definitely, yeah, it's one of my favourites.
I think it's I can definitely hear, like, you know, like, I guess more kind of current stuff. Like, I think Florence has definitely, like, pulled stuff from that. I think you listen to Florence and the Machine, and, like, just the way that she presents her vocals and the kind of build, I could definitely draw parallels to that track specifically. Okay, well, was there any honourable mentions on that one? Was there anything else that kind of popped into your head, or did you just go straight for that? Because this is generally the question when people are like, oh, this is a really hard one, this one. And it's like, I kind of weren't sure whether to go with this or this. Was there anything else that kind of popped into your head?
I'd have to say Hot Wind, Silver Machine.
You're getting your prog on today, aren't you?
Yeah, I was a bit of in my teens, when it was very uncool. Yeah. I always like to be different, but no, prog's never been a good, prog's always cool. I mean, I know it dips in and out, doesn't it? And it's become very, it feels like, you know, it's been embraced again, you know, and it's like everything, it evolves, doesn't it? Yeah. And it's become something different. But that's why I'm quite liking sort of the current music scene. So you go, yeah, you can hear in a lot of bands a lot of prog influences. Definitely. I mean, I know people used to say it was a bit navel gaze and a bit too clever, and some of it could be very pretentious. You know,
but I don't think it shied away from being pretentious, did it?
No, and that's what I love about it. Mm. I love the scale, you know, the scale of it. Because the first band I got into really was Gong,
right?
And you know, teenager, and there's lots of things I connected to in that whole sort of psychedelic world. And I love anything a bit trippy, a bit psychedelic, you know.
Well, I'm interested as to how you got into that, because you're younger than me, Max. And I was looking at it, and when I was kind of got to like the early 90s, and there was lots of kind of just coming out of like the Manchester music sort of explosion and what was going on, there was a lot of people that would sort of be floating around the clubs and pubs that are drinking with Gong t-shirts on, generally a lot of tie-dye as well. And it just felt like kind of, who was it? Was it Steve Hillage? And there was,
oh yeah,
I'm just trying to think what he was doing, a band called System 7 at the time, I think, and Osric Tentacles. And there was that kind of scene. Was that what you was getting pulled into then?
Well, the trouble with me, I am a little bit of a bandwagon jumper. So I was sort of into a few things, you know. And I did I really hit hard on the Manchester scene in the sort of like late 80s, early 90s. I'm not a big fan of the rave, you know, when people say rave, but, you know, clubbing. But as well, I grew up in Bolton, and we had two sort of pubs that you went to. One was if you're underage and into indie music, and one was if you were, you know, drinking age.
Yeah.
So there was the Boar's Head and the Blue Boar. And me and my friend Cheryl used to go to Boar's Head, and there was a guy in there. I must have been about 15. And I still remember, and I opened it, a guy called Gaff, and he had long hair, all in denim, and he had Angel's Egg, the Gong album, painted on the back of his jacket. He had a little beard and desert boots, and I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. So that's how I got, so straight away I went to X Records in Bolton, which was like, you know, the more alternative record shop, and just went and bought myself, you know, I went and bought Angel's Egg and then just went home and sort of, you know, lay my bedroom for about 8 hours listening to it, thinking, you know, my life has changed forever now, you know, as you do at that age.
Because, I mean, that's an intense bit of music for a 15-year-old, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. The intense of the best. I was very intense at that age. I don't quite, you know, I've come out of it now, thankfully. But,
That's quite crazy. I mean, I'm just thinking, I was literally throwing myself around my bedroom to like Mel and Kim. Meanwhile, you're there 8 hours into like a Gong album at 15. Incredible. Well, for track two, Max, I'm going to ask you the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Oh, it was the Mike Sam Singers, and it's Puff the Magic Dragon. And we had it. Well, I've still got it on a 7-inch, and I think White Horses was on the B-side. And it was one of those you could colour it, I don't, you remember them, they're sort of, they had the picture on the front and on the back you could colour in, and it had a picture of a dragon, you know, a cartoon dragon on the front. And I think it might have been my sisters and my Nan and Jim, who I spent a lot of time with when I was, you know, little. We used to get packed off every weekend. They used to have this little pull-out cupboard, and my granddad worked at Leyland Motors, and in there was all, he used to bring back engineering paper so I could draw on the back, and then his records, and it was like Paul Robeson, Ewan McCall, Nana Mascori he had in there, and then this Puff the Magic Dragon, and I used to love it, but it used, I mean, it still does. It makes me bawl like a baby. You know, but it's just that story of it and being devastated as a child, but believing, you know, really believing that somewhere there was this dragon that lived on this, you know, by the sea. Yeah, so that was
It'd be mine as well.
Was it?
Yeah, it's the first time. I mean, I won't say what my emotion is, but what was the emotion, Max, that you got from listening to that?
I think it was real melancholy, and it was the loss of somebody.
Yeah.
And I think that thing when you're a child, your imagination, isn't it? What you can, you know, you can imagine, but making that, look at me, I'm going to start crying. I just love it. Making that special friendship.
Yeah.
That very special friendship with somebody that nobody else knows. You know what I mean? It was the magic of it. Yeah. Maybe that's why then I went on to prog. You know what I mean? Because I wanted my own dragon. You know what I mean? I wanted that special that nobody else knew about, your own secret.
I mean, there was lots of Puff and lots of magic dragons in the world of prog, I'm sure.
Brilliant.
But it's such a somber sounding record, isn't it? And it's like there's like just a feeling of like longing and it I remember like vividly hearing that, like, because it was one of the first songs, I think, like when you're young, like you can picture it, like it's quite story like, isn't it, in the way that it's presented, and like, and you can kind of attach a sort of visual in your mind to it, and it's just got a lot of sort of longing, and
beautiful.
Yeah.
Have you heard Bonnie Prince Billy's version?
No.
Oh. So he did a version, maybe about 15 years ago, but that beautiful sort of baritone, you know, that's a beautiful, it is a really beautiful adaptation of it as well.
If you dig that out. Yeah. I literally heard he a new record from him this morning. They were playing it on Six Music this morning, and it made me think, I've not listened to him for ages. So, yeah. Right, that's what I'm going to go and check out his cover of Puff the Magic Dragon. Before we get on to school and stuff, so you mentioned like a few of the records that were floating around at home. So was there a lot of music on at home growing up?
Not really. So I spent a lot of time at my grandparents, and it was my nan and Jim, who was my step-grandfather. They were amazing. I mean, they were a real education for me in many ways, you know. But in our house, at sort of home, my sister was a new romantic, which wasn't really for me. I had a thing for Paul Young, and I remember going to the hairdressers and getting a terrible spiky mullet. I looked nothing like Paul Young.
You liked him enough that you wanted to look like him.
I got it all wrong as a child. I didn't have a boyfriend until later in life, and I realised now I wanted to look like, yeah. So I wanted the Paul Young. I remember it was very spiky. So I did like Paul Young, but my sister was a new romantic. My dad sort of like the Drifters, and he was a big like Randy Crawford, and my mum like Billy Joe, Frank Sinatra, Lovelace Watkins. She was into a guy called Lovelace Watkins, who you don't hear very, very much about now. And but I grew up in an area where it was, I think, you know, there was a lot of sort of new wave mods on the estate at the bottom of our road. Lots of scooter
boys. You're
talking
kind of early, sort of late 70s, early 80s, that second wave of mod.
Yeah, like, second wave. Yeah, so the sort of, second wave. So there was the mods, scooter boys, rude boys, and then you had your casuals. So it was all sort of, you know, sort of more mid-80s, like the, you know, so it was, there was a lot of music around.
So tribal then, wasn't it?
Oh, you can't, it's fascinating now because I can't tell. And you speak to youngsters and they'll, you know, they have amazing, beautiful tattoos and I go, what are you into? And they'll say, oh, and they're not, well, we always used to dress so much like our music. It seems very different now. Not, I'm sure lots of people do, but you know, people who look really sort of, they look fantastic and really out there. And then they'll be like, I'm just, you know, not really into any music or just into pop chart music or...
It's so strange. It is so strange. Aside from metalers, you know a metaller. You know, they've been consistent. Yeah. But that tribalism, you know, even moving, you know, throughout the 80s into kind of rave culture, you know, that kind of indie look and goths and things like that. And I know that I feel like I'm teetering on getting all like Old Man River here and, you know, back in my day, but I still run an alternative venue and that tribalism I can't see it. Whether or not I'm not meant to see it, I'm, you know, 47, I shouldn't be like looking out for these things, maybe not, but it does seem like a bit of a united sort of window of Topshop where everyone kind of looks good, but there's not that kind of, oh, he's into that or they're into that. Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Yeah, but I love, and I used to switch and that was the trouble. I used to sort of be into, you know, like I was wanted to be mods and then, you know what I mean, prog and then indie. I sort of went through everything.
Yeah.
And I always laugh at sort of the, you sort of meet people around the same age that we are, don't you get to the point and then you do look and I go, we all sort of know dress the same.
Yeah.
There's a lot of woodwork and stripes and, you know, Red Wings and stuff going on. And it's like, and you talk to people, we've all been through the same musical journey. It was into acid jazz, into, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Rockabilly, into this, into that, went through it all. And then we all talk going, we've all arrived at the sort of same place without consciously, you know, going, this is what we're all going to look like. Yeah. No.
As much as I experimented with most of them things that you just mentioned, I never went for the Paul Young haircut. I did swerve that one.
Still time, Stu.
All right, well, let's chat about school. And for track three, the song that reminds you of your time at school.
Yeah, Buffalo Soldier, Bob Marley. Now, it was funny because at first I was going, gosh, what really reminds me of school? Because my sort of, I had very few friends at school that I gelled with musically. You know, really, music was something I was into out of school. You know, something I sort of found, I suppose, by myself, really, or by people that I knew who weren't at the same school as me. But I had two brilliant friends, Justine and Lucy, and we were sort of opposite. We got into that. So we sort of 14, 15, straight into the Stone Roses. Baggy, you know, Manchester. But anything like that. We used to scour the enemy for anything that might sound, you know, I remember bands like the Milltown Brothers and, you know, they were on the radio the other day. What were they called? Who had the song LSD? What were they called?
Northside.
Not like, I'm not laughing at Northside. Nobody should laugh at
Northside.
That's
a great tune.
It is, it's a brilliant tune.
Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know, but we'd sort of try and find all the, you know, obscure bands, but there was not really anywhere for us to, I mean, we used to sort of, you know, try and get in pubs and fail, and then, you know, eventually did used to go down into Bolton. But the only place we had was a little cafe in West Orton. I went to a school called West Orton High, and there was a cafe called, we called it Tommy Vimto's, because round the windows had the Vimto sticker. And you used to go in there and get hot Vimto.
Hot Vimto,
yeah. In fact, there was a bar in Manchester called Common. It's a brilliant bar, and they have some great nights on. They started selling it. So a couple of years ago, it became quite trendy. But it was, we used to sit in there drinking hot Vimto, and they had a jukebox on, but none of it sort of related to us. But only track on there was Bob Matt. So we used to put on Buffalo Soldiers, we used to put it on repeat like 5 or 6 times. It must have drove everybody mad in the cafe. But we thought we were living our best life. You know, I still remember coming out one day, me, Lucy and Justine in our big 32-inch flares, and somebody shouted, "You've missed Woodstock." You know?
Second summer of love, I'll have you know.
But, you know, it was a little town, West Arden, and we did, you know, we did cut probably quite an odd figure, the three of us sort of scooting, you know, down Market Street, and we're starting in our giant flares, you know.
So did you enjoy school, Max?
I did. You know what? I was talking to my friend about it yesterday, and we said we didn't really learn much, but we loved it. And this is a friend, she'd gone to my friend Carla, and she went to a different school than me. But we're just saying that it was the fun. It was a sort of camaraderie. It was just messing about.
Yeah.
I just remember having a laugh, and, you know, very rarely bunking off school because you were frightened of missing out.
Yeah.
Not missing. It's awful when I thought I didn't go to school to learn. I went to have a good time.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
And I did.
Totally.
Did you?
Yeah,
did you?
Completely the same. Completely the same. And I didn't bunk off through that kind of fear of, oh, I don't know what you know, I don't want to miss out.
Yeah.
And it certainly weren't missing out on lessons. It was just missing out on the kind of banter that would have been sort of thrown around. And it's really strange. You know, my youngest daughter's 15, and she's sort of panicking about exams and things. And every part of me wants to kind of go, don't worry about it. Like, you'll be fine. Just enjoy it. Like, just enjoy school. Like, because, and it sounds like a really bad parent if I say, like, you know, it's just an exam, it's a bit of paper. You're really creative. You will excel in something far greater than, you know, what an exam result's going to give you. But I have to kind of, you know, my wife's like, you shouldn't be saying, you know, don't say that. Don't say that. And it's like, okay. It's just finding that balance, you know. But yeah, so what did you know what you wanted to be when you was at school?
I'd always fancied doing some kind of performing. And I think initially I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. Because I was a bit, you know, I was a bit raucous at school and a bit giddy. I think I just had too much energy. You know what I mean? One of those kids sort of chiding around. And, you know, people used to say, oh, you that. It's just when somebody says you'd be good at something, you go, oh, well, I'll do that then.
Yeah.
Not knowing, you know, the actual implication of trying to get into that sort of profession. And then I did start to think about acting because that seemed a bit more straightforward. But I straightforward in a way that I didn't actually have a clue how to start. I didn't know anybody who was an actor. You know, nobody knew anybody where I was growing up who was into acting. And everyone, I think my parents were worried because, you know, all they hear, you know, is 99.9% of actors are unemployed at one time. And I think there was a bit of well, what would you do? You know, sort of... I think it's just not an understanding, and it's out of your comfort zone and it's out of your world. So, but I did, yeah, by about sort of 12 or 13, I was sort of tentatively making moves towards it, but I still couldn't quite admit it to myself. I still think I was a bit embarrassed, and I never admit to anybody else I want to be an actor. I don't know why. It wasn't that I was ashamed. I just thought people would laugh and go, oh, don't be silly, you know, because I didn't look like, I think, what people thought at the time. I just looked like I was a larger teenager and, you know, base in her cut and a bit of a tomboy. And, yeah, so.
Was you a confident kid?
You know what? I don't think I was confident. This sounds very potential. I think I just saw when I was a kid, I just lived in the moment, didn't really think too much about things and did things. I was never overconfident, you know, I was underconfident, I think, because of my size. And it's like anything, kids pick up, don't they? Kids can be very cruel. Mm-hmm. So I got quite a lot of bullying about being big, but sort of at the time, nothing that I couldn't deal with, nothing that I thought I didn't expect. And you sort of, you know, that made me then, I suppose, become a bit of a performer because it was about making people laugh.
Yeah.
You know, I think you do take on that mantle of the fat, funny one.
Did you try stand-up?
God, no. And sometimes, I think, I'm so in awe of people who do it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm good friends with Diane Morgan, and Diane did it for about 10 years and she was fantastic, you know, but... You know, talking to her, it's really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, she didn't make it look hard. She made it look, you know, effortless. But I think that just relying on yourself, standing up there, and, you know, and comedians who have, you know, this career that spans for, you know, decades, and I go, how did they do it? That is something to keep producing that work. It's, no, I haven't got the skill set or the talent for anything like that.
Well, did you live out that in Funny Cow?
Well, that was it. I think that was my... Because Tony Pitts, who wrote Funny Cow, came to... We were filming a thing called Red Riding Trilogy. It was 1980, I think, we were in. It was Paddy Considine's episode, and me and Tony sort of played his sidekicks. He was a policeman in it. He was an inspector, I think. And Tony came to me and said, a producer's mentioned that I should write something for you from another company. And I said, really? He said, have you got any ideas? And I said, well, I've always had this fascination with women in working in the working men's club circuit, especially the 70s and 80s, because it must have been pretty unpleasant. Mm. But how they dealt with it, you know. And Tony went, I used to actually run comedy clubs. And I was like, get out of town. So, and Tony, and we talked about Marty Kane, and Tony went, oh, Marty Kane, you're my mum. And, you know, you just started this conversation going, this is all a bit weird. It sort of linked in that we had a lot in common, on especially with the ideas that I had. So Tony went away and wrote Funny Cow for me, and that's how it started. So yeah, I felt, yeah, I sort of got it out my sister. But
in style as well, Max. That's a wonderful film. It's wonderful.
Oh, thank you. No, it was great to do, and it was such, you know, it's one of those I used to say, if it gets made, I can sort of maybe retire. But, you know, there's certain parts that you just got, thank goodness that I got, because it took us 9 years to make.
Really?
Nobody wanted it. And, we touted it around and nobody was interested or they really wanted to change it. So in the end, we got this producer, Kevin Proctor, who basically went, I'll do it, and remortgaged his house and just really sacrificed a lot to get it made. And, yeah, so we owe a lot to him, you know. We got it done.
Wonderful. Track four, the first song you remember buying from a record shop.
No, what? Oh, it's Paul McCartney's Frog Chorus.
No one ever picks a cool one for this. You're fine.
I know. I was going on my second one, maybe my second one, which was Walls Come Tumbling Down by the Starcodes. But I was like, oh no, yeah, no. I had a big thing for Rupert the Bear. I mean, not right. Like you know, not a weird thing.
Purely platonic.
It was his check trousers, and because it was, you know, Rupert the Bear and the Frog Chorus, and. Yeah, and I think, again, it was that twee, you know, it was frogs. Yeah. It was creatures. You know, I was loved all that, of, you know, fairies and pixies and elves and, yeah. You know, again, moving on to Gong. But believing that there could be, you know,
yeah.
A world where, you know, things spoke or came to life in the evening. But I loved it, you know, Paul McCartney. And yeah, so that was my first.
Oh, when that came on Top of the Pops when you was a kid, it was great, wasn't it?
I know. But I'm always a bit like that. Oh, but yeah, you can. And when people are, we'd pick cool ones for the first records, because my partner's like, yeah, Ghost Town, the Specials was mine. I'm like, I'm not having that.
Yeah.
But he reckons it was.
You know? We've had a few that have kind of thrown in something, and I always just think no one was listening to John Peel and stuff then. No one was that cool.
No.
But then, I mean, you pulled it back. Your second one was Style Council, Walls Come Tumbling Down.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Great. What a tune that is as well.
I was a big Style Council. And I know I was getting, because I know Paul Weller says that he doesn't think it was his finest hour, the sort of Style Council. But him and Mick Talbot, I thought they were great. And I just thought the lyrics were amazing. And it was a very sort of potent time, wasn't it? And
the whole Red Wedge thing.
And yeah. And it was just for me. I mean, I was probably only about 10. In fact, I've got the Hour, it's just on my shelf there, the tape. I've still got the Hour Favourite Shop.
Wicked.
Grotty tape with my name on that. You know, I take it to the youth club and go, can you put this on? Go away with you, you know.
I love the jam, but I think Walls Come Tumbling Down is one of the best things Paul Weller's ever done.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And, you know, I just don't want to talk too much about politics, but you can play that track today. And
completely. Completely.
It still stands up very much about the current climate we're in, you know.
And bizarrely, when we move on to the next track, which we're going to now, the Style Council kind of is a reference point there as well. For track five, I'm going to ask you the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing.
Oh, Joe Smooth. Yeah.
Style Council covered that, didn't they?
Oh, God. Telling me something now, Stu. Look at me. Yeah, I was a real fan. Did they? Yeah. Really. And after buying the Frog Chorus, I bought the rest of the Paul McCartney's album.
I mean, so what? Tell me about Maxine and clubbing and that period as well, because Promised Land is just a glorious record, isn't it?
That's another one that actually emotional, it still gets me. And the lyrics to it, you know, you just think it was a real anthem about everyone, you know, about us all coming together. And, you know, and I do sort of have reservations that the club scene wasn't as always inclusive as it could have been, you know, in some, you know, and it's, and interestingly, I was doing, I wrote a play that was on at the Royal Exchange called Queens of the College, and it was about, set in the early 90s, and it was about the true story of four women, Anne Scargill, who was Arthur Scargill's wife then, and three other women occupied the Parkside Colliery near me. It was the last wave of pit closures. And one of the characters I'd written was like a wannabe, you know, sort of DJ. And I was doing some research around the character, and the character's heritage was Jamaican. His father came over from Jamaica, and his mum was white British from Wigan. and I was doing, you know, research about clubs and started, because I didn't really know much about street soul and all that sort of, so it was a real eye-opening, just starting to realise actually, because I probably didn't realise at the time that, like I said, the club scene wasn't, and in Manchester, you know, it wasn't as inclusive as it could have been. But I got him, and there was a scene in it where he put some music on and all the women dance. Well, actually, he shows them how to dance and they all join in. So there's no music because they're down at mine. But I got them to play that over. And it was just watching everybody in the theatre, especially of a certain age, going, oh, yeah, you know what I mean? Because it just, to me, was that early 90s. Yeah. And just going, I don't know, it was such an informative time for me, the club years and the friends you made, because you went all around the country. You know, we went up to Carlisle, Birmingham, Dewsbury, Hard Times in Dewsbury, you know, Miss Moneypenny's. We used to go to Liverpool a lot when it was the Academy before it sort of became Cream. Hacienda, when you could get in, that was quite difficult to get in.
Tell me about that, because it's, you know, from someone, you know, down in Essex, it was, you know, it's a stuff of legends. And to the right of me here, he's... a big poster of Tony Wilson, who's a big hero of mine, and I'm just, anyone that's ever been to the Hacienda, I'm very fascinated as to, you know, what their memories of it are, if they've got any.
It was I've got some really good memories, but I think again I was probably I started clubbing probably early 90s, but it could be, I've seen some sights.
You're meant to see some sights in the Hacienda, I'm sure.
But I mean, some pretty, you know, incidences that you go, oh, that was a little bit scary.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, the atmosphere, but it became very much, very quickly it became the place to go, obviously, didn't it? And then everyone was going. So then you do that thing where you go, well, everyone's going there. We need to go and find something a little bit new. You know what I mean? But I used to go to the best nights for me was it was a night called Flesh, which was someone's going to correct me. It might have been the last Wednesday or the first Wednesday of every month. And that was sort of an LGBTQ night. And it was amazing.
Who DJed at Flesh?
Oh, crikey. I'm trying to think. Paulette, I think lots of, I think every sort of,
I've had someone on here, and I'm sure they DJed at Flesh, and I can't think who it was. And it made me look into that club. It looked incredible.
Well, so it was, yes, on the Wednesday, and it was like anything. Everyone used to dress up. So people, you know, it was just sort of very little. But I mean, very little. Like, you'd see girls in little, like, pants, and then they'd just have gaffer tape over the nipples. And it was, you know, it was just really, and it was amazing. And again, as I was sort of sixth form age at this point, sort of 17, 18. And just going into this world again where you did feel really accepted. Because again, I was big, you know, and my big frilly shirt and my black, when I think, lots of black velvet chokers. I remember going through that phase. Leather trousers. I had leather trousers and these big red or dead boots that had a giant platform and big brass, you know, and a frilly, like a 70s frilly shirt. And a denim waistcoat, don't ask.
Oh, dear.
But actually, I was in one night in Flesh, and me and my friend, and at the time I'm name dropping now, but I went to sixth form with Sarah Cox.
Right.
Yeah, so we used to go clubbing together, me and Sarah and our friend Sonia, and we were dancing in there one night, and this guy came over to Sonia and Sarah, both very beautiful, obviously, and said, hey, girls, you know, we're doing this. We've got this show called Dance Energy. Would you like to come and dance on it? You know what I mean? We have guests and people come and you can be in the audience. And they went, yeah, but can our mate come? And I still remember his face. And he turned around and he went, oh, I suppose so.
Oh, how horrible.
Because he'd obviously been sent out to get some really gorgeous women, you know what I mean? You know, and you know, Sarah Cox is still absolutely beautiful. My friend Sonia's beautiful. And, you know, and then there's me with my velvet, you know. And you could see him sort of going, oh, God, all right then. So we went and met Normski on
It was
dancing.
Normski, wasn't it? Of course it was.
And the Shaman played in TLC. I still remember that. I remember videoing it, I'm sure.
Oh,
but
wow.
Flesh was amazing. And it was, yeah. it was so inclusive. It was, you know, there was the foam machines. It was the amazing drag acts. You know, it was out there. It felt like New York. You know, you felt like you were in some sort of, you know, hip place downtown New York. You know, it was a great place.
Looking at, I mean, some of the songs that you've chosen and some of the things that you've said already in scenes and things like that, like, have you always been kind of drawn to the more unusual and the more kind of exciting kind of side of I guess music and art? And
yeah, I think just I like things that are just, I do like offbeat more than, you know, and actually you sort of go, oh, look at my career, and actually it's sort of in some ways quite mainstream, but I try to be a little bit more, you know, I do a lot more in, you know, in independent film. You know, I'd like to be a bit more sort of indie in my career choices as well, you know. But, I just always like the slightly darker, a little bit more. So not always dark, but a little bit more psychedelic, just a little bit, fun. And trying to always, I think it's that thing, you know, you're always just trying to seek out something different.
Yeah.
And that always really appealed, underground, really, you know, what was going on in the, you know, underground. And then you get to an age where you realise you have no idea what, you know, that's what I miss now. It's like, I mean, you still discover things.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's places here about now, I've got, wow, that club sounds amazing, but
yeah.
I'd look like I was picking my kids up when I find
Max, about a it must have been about a year ago now. I was DJing at my club, and this young girl come up to the DJ booth, and I've been working there 30 years. Like it's been my baby, this venue, and she went, "Are you Stuart Whiffin?" And I just thought, wow. I thought, I'm still down with the kids. I was like, yes, I am. Yep. And she went, "My mum said to say hello. You went to school with her." And I just thought, oh, for a split second, I thought I was still cool. Nah, went to school
You're
with her mum.
You're very cool. You're still very cool. It's a state of mind.
Right, I'll tell myself that. For track six, Max, I'm going to ask you the favourite song from an artist from your home county.
Well, it's Elkie Brooks, who was born Elaine Bookbinder, who's from Salford.
Okay.
So she's just up the road. She lived in Broughton, which is not too far from where I am. And I just think she's got an extraordinary voice, Elkie Brooks. And there's something about this song again, it's a bit emotional, but I think I related to the story. You know, it's got, it's a bit like Puff the Magic, and it has a proper narrative to it about a woman who was once successful and ended up, you know, and just working in bars, you know, singing in bars. And there's a romanticism to that I quite
like.
There's some, the failed artist that I sort of could relate to, But, and I just, it always gives me a little, you know, it's a bit of an emotional punch for some reason. It's, and just her voice.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know, I remember somebody first telling me, you know, Elkie Brooks is from Salford. And I was like, I think actually I was on the bus as a kid and somebody drew on a mural and it was like Mark E. Smith, all these people. And I went, who's that? And then I didn't know. And then I remember going to high school, to college in Salford, at Salford Tech, when the teacher said, oh, that was Elkie Brooks. And I remember going, my Elkie Brooks. And I said, she's from Salford. And I was like, oh my goodness, I didn't know that. You know, because she was, I think Anisha is British, but,
about a month ago, I can't think what it was. It would have been some sort of music doc on the BBC, and it went into Elkie Brooks, because I didn't know too much about the band she was in, Vinegar Joe. Do you know much about them?
Not really, no.
Like, well, she was just this kind of, it was a programme about women in music, and they were talking about, in this rock band, Vinegar Joe, which was a kind of real sort of rock and rhythm and blues band, I guess. And she was just this incredible front person. But the guitarist in the band was Robert Palmer.
Of course, yeah.
And then I think the way it was portrayed in this film, that Robert Palmer's kind of ego started to kind of get a little bit dented with the attention that Elkie Brooks was getting, and then he would start presenting himself, singing more of the songs that he'd wrote and stuff like that, and it kind of figured the sort of end for her. And obviously, both of them then had very successful, you know, solo careers.
Yeah.
But that's one of them albums that, you know, growing up like you had, No One on a Scurry would be there, and then there'd always be an Elkie Brooks album floating about. Whenever I go crate digging in like charity shops now, there's still an Elkie Brooks album, a No One on a Scurry album. Some of them, remember they're like the Top of the Pops albums that had like a woman in a bikini on the cover, really bad cover versions. All right. For your last track, Max, I'm going to ask you a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear. Have you forgot this one?
Yeah.
So this is one that I knew nothing about.
Oh, it's Paul Robeson, isn't it? It's the Ballad of Joe Hill. So this to me, I grew up with, in my grandfather's house, there was quite a few Paul Robeson albums. But I just think this is such a he's got the most exquisite voice.
You mentioned a baritone voice earlier, and I thought, wait till people hear this.
Yeah. And again, it's another narrative, but it's a true story about Joe Hill, who was an organiser within the unions, and then there was a murder, and obviously they wanted in the same vicinity he was, and they pinned it on him. Because, you know, it's a sort of famous sort of saying amongst the left is, you know, don't mourn, organise, because that was his last words. He basically said, don't mourn for my death, because he went, you know, he was sentenced to death for obviously a crime he didn't commit. But that was, and it's just one of those as well. You know, I grew up in, my grandparents were very left wing, so I grew up in that sort of community.
Sure.
And a lot of people are, you know, and it's, you know, we're losing, you know, there's a lot of people passing away now and that, you know, and I'm losing a lot of comrades and friends, you know, people, it's like anything getting older, but it's always a favourite at sort of left-wing funerals. My friend Betty Tebbs, who was sort of 96 when she passed away, that was, we all sung it at her funeral. But I just think Paul Robeson, I hope somebody's making a film about him. I'm sure they must be.
Oh, my God. I know very little about him, and I read up on him, and that was the next thing I was going to say to you, was someone needs to make a film about this guy. Yeah. His life is incredible.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. He's an extraordinary just human being and what he did you know, obviously... As you know, we're talking current day about the Black Lives Matter, but for the movement, civil rights movement, but just, you know, politically in general, he's a huge inspiration to so many people I knew growing up, and it, you know, really opened me up and educated me about, you know, Paul Robeson and bigger issues, and, you know, so yeah, somebody's got to do a film.
I literally read a brief sort of synopsis about him. About the fact that he was, you know, a high-profile sports person, and obviously become an activist and was an actor, and so much of it, and like literally moving around the world as well. Like his story was just incredible, and lived for a long, long time as well. Like it was,
and I think he's sort of, I don't think underrated, but he's not as widely known about as I feel he should be. And I think obviously his politics probably had quite a bit to do with you know, in getting, not, he wasn't silenced. Well, you know, he had a lot of battles. Well, as in moving on, but he suffered a lot of distress and hardship, you know, because of his beliefs, and he stuck to his beliefs, and he's a real inspiration, you know.
If we sort of find ourselves coming out of lockdown, Max, what are you looking forward to, and what's coming up? I mean, we should also say that we're recording this on the 14th, and last night was the first showing of Mandy, and oh my God, that was just brilliant. Like bonkers,
she's
hilarious.
Like, the fact that still I kept laughing about beating up most killing squashing tarantulas to Harry Belafonte singing No Belafonte's Banana Boat. Harry Belafonte is another, he's another hero, but she's just brilliant. It's just brilliant. It was so needed. I mean, even the episode I was in, I still laughed out loud. And, yeah. I'd read it. I did watch it last night. I mean, I know. But I just wanted to watch it to see
what
Diana had done. But she's brilliant. I've known Diane since we were about 17, 18.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. And then I knew, you just know when you meet somebody. We met auditioning for Manchester Metropolitan Theatre School. Manchester Met, they had a theatre school there, and we were up, and I didn't get in, Diane didn't get in, but I saw her and went, God, you're really good. And then she went, oh, you're really good. So we found out we didn't live too far from each other. She lived in Kersley and I lived in Bolton.
Yeah.
So we became pals, and she used to write stuff and do these brilliant little characters, and she's just a real comedy aficionado. She knows her stuff. You know, while I was into bands and going out clubbing, you know, she'd have Tony Hancock and Markham and Weiss posters on her wall. And, you know, but I'm so pleased for her. And I just thought, you know, we need more and more Diane Morgan on screen. Definitely. Especially, you know, we just need more laughs.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really looking forward to Spitting Image coming back and things like that. But we need... I think we do, don't we? A lot more, a bit more comedy, please.
So what have you got coming up?
So what have I got coming up? Well, touch wood, everything being okay. Now, obviously, the theatres are being able to open. I did, at the beginning of lockdown, the remounted Alan Bennett's Talking Heads. And I did one called Miss Fozzard. Thank you. Miss Fozzard Finds a Feet. So we're going to put them on at the Bridge Theatre in London.
Oh, wonderful.
So Nick Heitner, who originally sort of, I think it was his idea really, came up with it, who sort of produced and directed some of them. And I think it was his company out of the Bridge Theatre, is, you know, and I think it's such a great idea to get people back. So there'll be two monologues a night, no interval, and then obviously socially distanced audience. And so I'm really looking forward to doing something. Looking forward to going to London. I mean, the fact of going anywhere at the moment, I was like, I'm going to get on the train. Oh my goodness! But because you just get a little bit, you do find it's like, well, if I don't need to go out, I won't.
Yeah.
I went into London
yesterday, and got the train into London, and it was quite strange. It was like where I get out, I have to sort of walk through like the big business sort of district. And to get to East, and it was quite strange at like 8 o'clock in the morning to walk through what's generally full of like thousands of suits and there being nobody. And it sounds weird, but it was quite nice walking through an empty London and just going, this is, it's, you know, I've never seen it like this before. It's quite nice to be able to kind of have a casual walk and not get caught up in the hustle and bustle of walking twice as fast as I normally would. It's really nice to have a little sort of stroll through London. And then as I got into sort of East a little bit more, it was the kind of, you could see a lot more sort of creatives had sort of started to sort of come back into town. And there was what there has been, which I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. Whilst London's been empty, there's been some incredible street art painted everywhere. I think everyone's been out with their spray cans and stencils, but like there was some amazing street art. But I don't know if I should be endorsing that, but it looked great.
Brilliant.
Well, Max, I'm going to put together a Spotify playlist to accompany this so everybody can go and listen to all of your tunes and the Frog Chorus. and not just the tunes, but some of the other ones that we've spoken about. And I can't thank you enough. I've had an absolutely lovely time talking to you.
Me too. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's lovely to meet you.
There you go. Maxine Peake. Box ticked, bucket list, big cross through it, done. And what an absolute pleasure it was as well. I don't need to tell you how great Maxine was. You just listened. And it was... super fun chat. Go and check out all of the songs that we spoke about on the Spotify playlist. Just go and search Off the Beaten Track on Spotify, and you'll find lots of the podcasts. But also, once you find the one that's got any one of the previous guest playlists on, click that to the page, and then you can have a little rummage around until you find the one you want to listen to. Thanks ever so much for listening. As mentioned at the beginning, if you enjoy creative people talking about the records that have soundtracked their creative journey, then go and have a look in the archives, because it's rammed full of really, really nice chats with lots of wonderful musicians, actors, DJs, producers and comedians and anyone else that makes great stuff in the arts. So go and have a look. You can find out about all of this stuff at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. I'm back, Snick. There we go. Nearly got through that without getting tongue-tied, but hit the last hurdle. Thanks again for listening. Thanks once again to Maxine for giving up her time. I'll be back next time. See you soon. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.